Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Mod State Podcast. Thanks for tuning in today. For those of you who are listening outside of the United States and somewhere else on this globe, welcome. We will be discussing things that I guess transcend both domestic and into international politics, military, etc. And for those of you who are tuning in within the United States borders, thank you. We've certainly increased our outreach and your comments and criticisms and narrations, whatever you want to call them, are exceedingly welcomed. So, this podcast today, it is a rare solo podcast. John will not be joining me, but we will be back. I think the plan is to keep some of these solo podcasts. If you listen to the podcast from the inception over a year ago, I did do solo podcasts a little bit more frequently. And I think with both John and I's schedule, you'll probably see an reemergence of the solo podcasts. But the plan is to have John write some counterpoints to anything that I say on these podcast episodes, and or have a essentially solo podcast in rebuttal. I don't know how much there will be to rebut on this solo podcast. I read an article just recently. It was actually posted on Huffington Post, and it was is an article written by Will S. Hilton, and he essentially did, it was about a 7-hour interview with Glenn Greenwald. And for those of you who don't know who Glenn Greenwald is, he is best known for his investigative journalist, although Edward Snowden was the one who dumped all the information on him, but he was the one that really chronicled Edward Snowden's departure from the United States and then the NSA essentially spying on its citizens. So that's where you probably have heard of Glenn Greenwald. And he is a controversial writer. For the beginning of his career, he wrote a lot about, I would say in favor of the left, wrote against President Bush quite a bit, criticized Obama, but also pushed his policies forward in agreement. But he just wrote, so definitely controversial. I think he riles up liberals quite a bit because I think he is fairly progressive. However, he just sort of writes about it as he sees it. So this 7-hour interview was condensed into an article, of course, which I will post in the show notes because none of this is my work. But to save you the time to read the article, even though you can read it when I post it, I wanted to go through this article. And I'll read some of it verbatim and then give my opinion, and I'll do my best to delineate between the Will and Glenn Greenwald and myself. The reason I liked this article is because I think it hits home to what both John and I try to elucidate on a weekly basis when we push episodes out. So I think there's a lot in this article, this interview, that I see Glenn's point, and I think he takes a step back and approaches everything from a macro perspective. And I think what we do, and there's nothing wrong with having a micro perspective on things within the United States or internationally. There's nothing wrong to be principled on small things, little topics. But what happens is that becomes a very insular point of view, a very narrowed point of view, and it becomes difficult to see outside that narrow perspective. And I think Glenn Greenwald, there's a bit in here that I disagree with, but his macro perspective is what I like. So let's just dive into this. So the article really, I mean, it transcends Russia. It talks about Russia. We talk about politics in the U.S., military intervention, etc. So we'll just dive into this here. So Will starts with asking Glenn Greenwald about Russia. And a lot of what Glenn Greenwald talks about here is really the facts of the case. And this is a case that John has made over and over, and I suppose I've agreed with it and probably talked about it myself, is that the facts are what they are. And we don't know enough about what's going on to make assumptions. And in cases of law and bringing indictments or charges against somebody, you do need facts and you do need evidence. So it doesn't mean that I want to see the president burn for anything that's happened. It's not that I want to see Cohen or Manafort go away for years. That's not the case. But if the evidence is put before me, I can make a better decision. And it's better for me, in my viewpoint, sort of centrist, if you will, it's better for me to have facts laid out before I'm making blanketed assumptions about things. So here's Will. His first question is, let's dig into Russia. I think your concern here is about evidentiary standards, not doubting whether Moscow could or would do bad things. But I also think you're arguing that if the allegations are true, they're still not as serious as people are making them out to be. So I want to ask you about both. So Glenn says, okay, first let me express my happiness and gratitude about hearing my views, blah, blah, blah. I think there is evidence. I wouldn't say proof. That has been presented by social media companies, as well as journalists, that pretty strongly suggests some degree of Facebook and Twitter messaging or originated from circles connected to, or maybe even part of the Russian government, Will says. So there is enough evidence that you accept the social media operation happened? Well, I think there are serious questions about the magnitude of it, the impact of it, and the intention behind it. But yeah, I accept provisionally. I mean, I'm persuaded that there were at least some Facebook ads and some tweets posted by Russians. Will says, a lot of this was first reported by Adrian Chen in 2015, but the February indictment from Robert Mueller made very specific allegations about Russia's internet research agency, its street address, its mission to accomplish information warfare against the United States, and that the staff was an 80 full-time employees with a budget of $1.25 million a month. Do you find that kind of specificity compelling? Glenn says, I think allegations in an indictment are inherently unreliable because prosecutors are making a case. That said, once an indictment rises to a certain level of specificity, in order to dismiss it, you would have to assume that Mueller and his team are literally fabricating information. I don't think that's likely. So yeah, I think the allegations of indictment can be regarded as evidence, provided they are very concrete and specific, as those were. What about the second Mueller indictment? This is Will now. About the Russian government hacking the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta. Glenn says, I regard that indictment as the first instance of actual evidence being presented to the substantive to substantiate the allegations that the Russian government was involved in the hacking. It still obviously isn't evidence that Putin ordered it, nor is it proof that the Russian government did it. There are still lots of questions I have about it and how it's linked to the GRU and how reliable the evidence is. There seems to be some implied suggestion that either they had human intelligence or signal intelligence, or both, that led to this knowledge. I want to be able to evaluate that in order to test the veracity of these claims. But yes, because of the level of specificity, I do regard that indictment as evidence. Will goes on to say, or ask rather, so there's enough evidence to believe the Facebook and Twitter operation happened. But on the hacking of Democrats, you believe there's some evidence, but it's not determinate. He says, Glenn says, that's precisely accurate. But I don't think that these kind of disinformation and misinformation and propaganda campaigns by and among these countries have been going on for decades. It would be more surprising if the Russians weren't doing things to infect U.S. discourse with information that they regarded as beneficial to their interest, because U.S. has many programs like that as well. So this is me now. Well, it's always been me. But this is something that John and I have touched on frequently in this episode, and it becomes sort of a moral high ground in terms of what is happening in the United States and what the United States does to other people. I think it would be ignorant for any American or any global citizen, rather, to think that the United States doesn't do this. So if we can all agree that the U.S. is doing this, then where is the moral high ground and who takes it? Now, in a team USA, you can make the argument that, well, we are influencing elections and leaders in the world in context of democracy, in to push a democratic agenda. And that's where in Russia, there is no democratic initiative. There is no democratic agenda. It is Russia's agenda to interject their ideals in the world and control. And it's harder for Russia, of course, to do this. It's not so much that they would like to push their ideological or political ideology forward. I don't think that's the case. I think the case is to have Russian power, whereas the United States, one might argue that it's not necessarily U.S. power in a colonialism type of sense, but it rather is democratic values. So there are two different things here. And so when people come to the defense or say, well, the United States does all this as well, one could make the argument that it is different. Now, are there cases that the United States, are there cases that they do this and it isn't necessarily in the interest of democracy? I think you could probably dig deep and find evidence that it is not, but it effectively is the greater of the two evils. And well, you can do the math there depending on who that candidate is. So it goes on to say, Will says, right, of course, the U.S. effort to install Boris Yeltsin is a good example, and we spread malware all the time in other countries. But you wouldn't suggest that whatever the United States government does is the model upon which we decide what's right and wrong? Glenn says, no, but it's highly relevant to the question of how we treat revelations about what other countries are doing, whether we treat it as a standard practice among countries and respond accordingly, or we prevent that it's some kind of 9/11 or Pearl Harbor, like an aberration and a violation of international norms. So this is sort of the ongoing debate, especially in the era of cyber warfare or the ability to communicate the way we do today, the way we send information. And this is me off of the narration of this article, but it really is trying to set a standard and how we go about this in this new world that we have today. As we know, the internet is a fairly unregulated place. I think some people would like that, and not necessarily the regulation of information, but the idea of repealing net neutrality and putting the power back into providers. But it really is deciding that, okay, if we're all going to do this, then how do we go about it, and what is normal and what is not normal, what is abnormal? So Will goes on to say, a fair number of reporters believe the Shadow Brokers, a hacker group that spread malware developed by the National Security Agency, was also a Russian operation that cost hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. Do you still think that represent the norms of international affairs? So Glenn says, I've been thinking about this. Maybe part of the reason why I see these things differently than a lot of other journalists and a lot of other people is because how I spent the 2 years of my life recently. Will's probes. What do you mean? He goes, other than reading through top secret documents about what the US and their little allies do to the rest of the world when it comes to cyber invasions and spying and disinformation campaigns, I mean to watch the US turn around and play the victim is very difficult to swallow, given that I know what the US does to the exact countries and many, many others in the world. Will says, I guess there are two different ways to evaluate the seriousness of an espionage operation. One is whether the effort was unusual, and another is to gauge the impact. I think a lot of people believe the 2016 election is so serious because of the impact. Glenn says, the US government is pretty effective in its disinformation and cyber invasion campaigns. It's not like they're playing around with trivialities. Everyone knows that the US government has on many, many occasions, not just a very distant history, but recent history, done things like actually change governments and overthrow governments. So, Will says, sure, but installing a president of the United States has a much bigger global impact. Glenn goes on to say, I mean, I guess if you're liberal in America, you think it's worse, but if you're Chilean, Will says, but the leader of the United States exerts power everywhere. Glenn says, no, I refuse to accept that. I find that offensive, actually. Will says, why? Well, I think it's a very ethnocentric way of looking at the world. It's very self-centered. And I'll get to a little bit more of this in my opinion here. But Will says, no, it's just that America has a crook as a president. It affects the entire planet. Glenn says, that would be a valid argument if the only instance in which the U.S. had done this was Chile or other tiny little countries that don't have an effect on anyone other than the people who live in that country. But you yourself just referenced the fact that the U.S. played a significant role in the election of Boris Yeltsin, and look what happened in Russia. The suffering and the deprivation as a result of the privatization and neoliberal policies that Yeltsin ushered in, which is what made the U.S. want to support him in the first place, and Russia is not Chile. They have massive stockpiles of nuclear weapons and a serious military. The U.S. has meddled there all the time. The U.S. has done the same thing in Iran, trying to undermine and destabilize the current government, let alone deposing the Shah. Saudi Arabia has great influence on a lot of people around the world as well, including what they're doing in Yemen, which the U.S. is directly responsible for propping up that government. The U.S. is interfering constantly. Will says, obviously don't misrepresent what I'm saying. In any case, the U.S. meddling in other countries, horrible things happen, but no one affects the world like an unhinged and dangerous American president. Glenn says, I just think there's a ton of assumptions embedded in the claim that I don't accept, beginning with the idea that the difference between Hillary Clinton winning and Donald Trump winning is so vast for the entire world. I think there are differences between the two candidates in terms of policies that they would have implemented primarily in the U.S. But what are the grave differences that the rest of the world is suffering under Donald Trump, which they wouldn't have been suffering under Hillary Clinton? So when I read that, my response was exactly Will's next response. And he says, okay, that's a better argument. Glenn goes on to say, I think it also depends on minimizing the effect of what we call U.S. meddling, dismissing or trivializing how many people have suffered as a result. Will says, that's a horrible thing to say, and you know it's not true. Glenn says, no, I'm not attributing bad motive. I'm not saying that you're looking at the world ethnocentrically by, and then Will says, well, what did you say? Well, you did say that, and it's wrong. Glenn says, no, I was, but I'm not now. I'm saying that regardless of motive, it's a wrong analysis. Trump was against a lot of wars that Hillary wanted. You could make a very strong case that if Hillary Clinton won, there would be countries that we would be bombing, which we are currently not, like Syria. So, I think this is a fairly good time to step back and try to pick apart the sort of macro perspective that Glenn Greenwald proposes here. And, you know, one thing that we hear in this country is, well, you know, Hillary would have been a better president. We would have been better off with Hillary. And, or, you know, she won the popular vote. Donald didn't. The electoral college is now sort of an archaic thing in our country, institution in our country. But to me, and I think this is important for people to think about, and I won't say listeners, but to think about, is really the macro perspective of what the presidency is and what an administration is. And I'm not talking about the road to fascism or the road to being a fascist nation again. I think a lot of things would have to happen in order to let that happen. And I think in your political sphere of influence, the way that you think ideologically, that it is very relative. And I mean that if you can't take a step back and see election cycles and administrations for as cyclical as they are, that you run the risk of thinking that the apocalypse is on your doorstep, that one wrong administration will throw the world into chaos, and any policy that is good today will be undone, and we're headed towards a bridesmaid's or handmaiden's tale type of nation. And I concede that it is true that it does take just one administration for things to go wrong. I mean, you could point to Stalin or a Hitler, that it was one administration that did catastrophic things for this world. But, and I'm not saying that the U.S. is not at risk for something like that happening. I think history shows us that anything is possible. But I like to look at the macro perspective that we have here. And I'm not really a Hillary supporter, and I'm not a Trump supporter. I think most of you have found that to be clear at this point. But it is true. When you look at the macro, not the specific policies, not the micro issues that we have here, but the specific time in which we are at in the United States, that whether it's a lesser of the two evils or not, that policies are inherently different, and the one thing that you might like about one candidate might be completely opposite from the other candidate that you have. And that's, and what I mean by that is exactly what Glenn brought up in this article, that he says, look, and it's true, Donald Trump was opposed to some of the wars that Hillary Clinton was in favor of. And it could be very true that her hawkish sort of international view or point or policies could be different from the current president that we have. You don't know what kind of wars we might be in today. You don't know what campaigns we would be having. You don't know if we're in something like 147 countries in our military sort of influence, which of those countries would be more aggressively mobilized to push forth some sort of quote-unquote democratic agenda in those countries. So again, it's a good macro perspective to look at, that you know, you might be, your eyes may be bigger than your stomach. And I'm not saying that it is a bad thing to have principled beliefs or principled viewpoints on certain micro issues. Again, it's not the point. But you can always wonder what it would be like, but I think you have a higher statistical probability of being more involved militarily with someone like Hillary Clinton. That's just the case. A lot of progressives, liberals would like to see a roll down of the military-industrial complex. And for the most part, our military interventions haven't changed much under Donald Trump. There was an uptick in operations in Syria before Donald Trump was the president. So to say that would be one aspect of Donald Trump's presidency, the increased funding to the DOD is an inherent negative, I think you'd probably see that with Hillary Clinton too. Or even if there wasn't an increase in DOD expenditure or tax money to that, you might not see as much, but I'm pretty sure you probably would still see the same amount or more military campaigns. So back to the more interesting article than what I am saying. So, Will goes on to say, but you will admit that a U.S. president has more global impact than a despot in a small country. Glenn says, if you want me to acknowledge that the U.S. is the most powerful country in the world, I will acknowledge that. So who leads the U.S. has more consequences for the world than who leads any other specific country. Will says, and if you instill a dangerous president here, it amplifies the damage we do elsewhere. So, Glenn says, well, I don't know. Trump ran on the whole idea of America first, which is very isolationist and a xenophobic way of looking at the world that says that we shouldn't be engaged internationally. We shouldn't be concerned with who's leading other countries, changing leaders to make other countries better. We should be focusing on only ourselves. I mean, that's the Trumpian worldview. Will says, no, that's not. That's what he ran on, but he's actually been advocating for dictators all around the world. He's been out there praising Duterte and empowering autocrats, and he launched the strikes in Syria relatively early in his presidency. And he's currently backing Saudi Arabia and Yemen. To which Glenn says, the Syria strikes that Hillary Clinton supported. Will says, I'm just saying, he's not an isolationist. He only pretended to be in the campaign. Glenn says, but if you look at the Syria debate, I think that was the most clarifying, because what got overlooked is that Hillary Clinton had an ongoing sustained critique of Obama's foreign policy, which was that he was insufficiently interventionist, in particular when it came to confronting Russia both in Ukraine and Syria. These are her two predominant critiques of Obama's foreign policy, that he didn't do enough to oust Assad, and he was not willing to arm with lethal weapons anti-Russian factions in Ukraine. Trump in both instances essentially sided with Obama, although he did actually end up sending lethal weapons to Syria. Will says, yeah, I think you have to distinguish between what he said during the campaign and what he's actually done as a president. Glenn says, if you look at Syria, I don't think you can make the argument that the U.S. has been involved in any serious effort to dislodge Assad, notwithstanding those two strikes. Will says, he stepped it up from Obama. Glenn says, I don't think that's true. Will says, his strikes in Syria were a step beyond Obama and a direct contradiction of his own campaign. Glenn says, there's a weird contradiction between, on the one hand, claiming that Russians wanted to install Trump because they thought he was going to be some kind of puppet of Russian interests, and then on the other hand, saying he's involved in a serious effort to dislodge one of Russia's most important client leaders. Will says, not really. An effort to install a president doesn't necessarily produce the results you wanted. Glenn says, what do you mean? Will says, just because he didn't do what Russia wanted in Syria doesn't mean that he didn't think he would when they worked to elect him. Glenn goes on to say, one of the reasons why the Russians favored Trump in the campaign was because Trump's policy was that the U.S. had no business trying to bring about regime change in Syria, which was more favorable to the Russians than Clinton's position that Obama should have done more to dislodge Assad. Yes, Trump did symbolically and in a very kind of inconsequential way on two separate occasions bomb Syria, both times applauded by Hillary Clinton. But I don't think anyone thinks there has been a serious effort to bring about regime change in Syria. If anything, he has partnered with Assad against ISIS and against Al-Qaeda, which was also Obama's position. So I think the point here is that it's easy to exaggerate the difference for the rest of the world between Clinton and Trump. The reality is, Trump has not started new wars. He has escalated the bombing of ISIS in Syria and Iraq in a horrific way that's killed a lot of civilians. I think Hillary Clinton would have done the same. I think Clinton probably would have been more militaristic about involving the U.S. in Syria. She said she would, and I take her word for that. So I don't actually think the difference for the rest of the world between these two has been nearly as grave as you're suggesting. I think the primary differences have been domestic. Mina. This was a chunk of the article that I enjoyed reading. And it, again, as a centrist here, as a person that really tries to take a step back and see what happens in these sort of four-year cycles, that, of course, pending some sort of crazy authoritarian overthrow in the United States, which probably won't happen, that we see these sort of administration and their policies, executive orders, come and go in a four-year process, or 8 years for the last two presidencies. And I think it's important because there's a lot of people that love to hate Trump. And look, there's plenty that Trump does on a daily basis that drives me up the wall. But I have to take a deep breath. Yes, I've expressed numerous times on this podcast that I think a lot of what Trump is doing is damaging. And a lot of what, in terms of relations and our standing in the world as being taken serious. And to be honest with you folks, this is a four-year cycle. I don't think, for whatever reason, let's just say and hypothetically pretend that Joe Biden or a Mike Pence or we can go back and forth on right and left, that any of these number of statesmen or career politicians would somehow become the president in 2020 and the world would look back on the last 4 years and say, well, we can't take you serious anymore. Well, you just blew it over the last 4 years. That's done. We can't take you serious anymore. It's over. That's not the case, folks. And this is my opinion. You might have a different one, so please let me know if you do. But this just isn't the case. People see what the president is, and as much as the rest of the world doesn't take the president seriously, or in some cases they do, depending on what he's saying, I just don't think that for some reason were sort of ruined in the next 4 years. And the other thing too is people love to hate the president. And I think we've said this before in the podcast, the man could find the cure to cancer, the cure to AIDS, and push it forth to the entire world, and people would still find a reason to hate him. I think Glenn's trying to make the point here that what would be much different other than domestic policy? Things like universal health care, which I don't know that Hillary Clinton would back, or increased spending for public education, or free education at the collegiate level. Like, I don't think Hillary Clinton is backing any of these things. And who knows? It's hypothetical. I'm sort of making assumptions here. But other than sort of this isolationist stand that the president has taken, are we that much worse off? And I'm not here defending the president. It sounds like I am, but I'm really looking at this from a macro perspective. How much worse off would we really be in terms of what we're doing and the money we are spending overseas? All right. So Will goes on to say, okay, so if both of the Mueller indictments are true, how much impact do you think Russian interference had on the outcome of the election? Glenn says, it was really close. So I'm not going to say definitively that certain Facebook ads or tweets or even the release of emails didn't alter the outcome of the election. But what always bothers me about the analysis is that it isn't like the Democrats just lost the presidential election in 2016. They are essentially collapsing as a national political force. And the success of Obama and his unique political talent masked that. They've lost, as you know, the House and the Senate and state houses and governorships all across America. So on the list of causes why Hillary lost, I think Russian interference falls very, very low down on the list. When you compare it to the perception that Democrats are the party of Wall Street and Silicon Valley and the choice of someone like Hillary Clinton, who represents the status quo at the time when the status quo is uniquely hated, and the terrible campaign she ran and the terrible messaging of America is always great, is already great, and the whole perception of dishonesty surrounding the Clintons for a long time, those things are much more significant to me than some Facebook ad and even reporting on those emails. You said it pretty well, Glenn. I mean, this is something we've been echoing over and over on this podcast in a mod state. It isn't, folks, and I'm sorry, but it isn't as if Facebook and Russian bots and Russian hacking lost the election for the Democrats in 2016. That is not the case. Now, for all you Bernie Sanders supporters out there, yes, I get it. That was a rigged system for Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton. But let's be honest, I don't think Bernie would have won. That's just not the case. I don't think that the United States was ready for Bernie Sanders' platform. I think it takes something like a Donald Trump. I think it takes continued quote-unquote suffering from the middle class, from blue-collar workers and wage stagflation to see something like the Bernie Sanders platform come to fruition. It just wasn't going to happen. I think your best bet was Hillary Clinton. Well, might not have been Hillary Clinton, but someone like Hillary Clinton. And at the end of the day, she lost. And she lost because of Democratic messaging, because they lost who they truly were. There's a really good book called Listen Here, Liberal. And I'll post it in the show notes because I'm blanking on the author's name at this point. But the entire book references the fact that Democrats lost their messaging. They were for the blue-collar worker. They were for the worker. They were for those protections. And they went away from it. They went into venture capitalist tech, moving the world forward in that way. And they lost touch with the people who would never be venture capitalists, who would never be making their money in tech, would never be visionaries that way. And when you lose those people, you know where they go? They go to someone like Donald Trump. And they don't do it because they like his xenophobia or his isolationism. They don't care. Listen, if you can't pay your bills, if your wages are not rising, if you're not making enough money, if your basic Maslow hierarchies of needs aren't met, you don't care about immigration. You don't care about things like that. You care about getting your jobs back. And you don't care what job that is. You're not worried about the environment. You're worried about putting food in your kids' mouths. You're worried about how you're going to pay your mortgage or pay your rent. And when someone like Donald Trump stands up and says, I'm bringing jobs back to America, and Hillary Clinton doesn't, who the hell are you voting for? So it's up to the Democrats to figure out their re-messaging. How are they going to win back these voters? And they're not going to do it with Hillary Clinton's messaging. Okay, enough of my rant. Will goes on to say, how do you rate the significance of the Russian meddling compared to the Comey letter? We're going to bomb through this. This is not as fun. The point of the next little piece of this, and you, of course, you can go back and read it, but the meat of this next section is talking about the difference between the Comey letters or the tweets or the Russian bots, you know, all this stuff that I think a lot of diehard liberals and progressives like to latch on to, that, well, this was a major influence. The Comey letter was a major influence. All this stuff was a major influence. And again, at the end of the day, I'm going to argue that no, it was not. Might it have a statistical higher chance that maybe some people voted against Hillary Clinton? Maybe. But I don't believe it was enough to swing the election. And I don't mean just to the presidency. I mean to the House, to the Senate, to governor races across the United States. I mean, look at the overall amount of Republicans in governor positions across the United States. The conservatives far outweigh the Democrats. So why is that? Is that because of Russian interference? Is that because of tweets? Is that because of bots? Or is that because of just damn messaging? I mean, what is it? You ask yourself that question. So anyway, this is the meat of that, talking about Facebook and what social media companies have to do in the future to sort of protect free speech away from this disinformation. And of course, disinformation and or misinformation or fake news, all this kind of stuff. I mean, this is something that's evolving and that we have to really reckon with. So the question he asks is, then what should Facebook be doing right now? This is Will asking. How should they be handling these threats to our system? So Glenn, and I take Glenn pretty seriously when he talks about things like cybersecurity. I mean, he did spend 2 years doing this in terms of the revelations from Edward Snowden. So he says, when we talk about problems, I think it's important to talk about not just the current problem, but also the problems that might come from the proposed solution. So obviously, I think it's bad that if the internet is being used to deceive people with fake news or fabricated claims, but a lot of what you're calling the Russian disinformation campaign wasn't based on false things. Like the emails, for example, were all true. It's not like any of them were forged. And a lot of Facebook ads that have been identified as originating from Russia voiced valid critiques that people in the US voiced as well. So I think we have to be careful to distinguish between propaganda that is grounded in truth and accuracy, or even real opinion versus actual deceit. And I would agree that the latter kind of campaigns are destructive. The question then becomes, are these campaigns more destructive than empowering Facebook to regulate the internet content? I have a lot of sympathy for Mark Zuckerberg in that interview he did with Kara Swisher. He was widely criticized for what he said when she was asking things like Holocaust denial. I don't understand why he should be the one acting as the arbiter of truth. You know, the internet, if you look back at what was said about it, about why it was such an important and exciting human innovation, was that it was going to be this area where human beings were going to be able to disseminate ideas and communicate with one another, free of constraint. Now we're talking about having an unaccountable corporate giants who are really monopolies, more or less regulating what can and can't be said on the internet, a power that they don't actually want. Will says they clearly don't, but you don't think Facebook has any of the obligations that a publisher is bound to? Glenn says, I see Facebook more like AT&T than the New York Times. Will says, what is your assessment of the evidence that the Trump campaign was interested in coordinating with the Russian government? Glenn says, I think we have to divide the question a little bit more for me to answer it fully. If you go back to 2016 and look at what the original allegations were that actually led to the Mueller appointments, the suspicion was that Trump or the Trump campaign collaborated or conspired with the Russians to actually commit the crime, to do the actual hacking. I don't think there's any evidence whatsoever that Trump or Trump officials worked with the Russians to perpetuate the hacking. I don't even think anyone claims that anymore, even if they still harbor suspicions. Instead, we have now reverted to this much vaguer term called collusion, which, as everyone knows, doesn't really have a legal meaning, and it now includes things like a willingness to possibly receive information that the Russians obtained about Hillary Clinton and was harmful to her in order to confer advantage on the Trump campaign. I think the Trump circle is open about that fact and has been about the fact, and the reason they went to that Trump Tower meeting was because they were lured to it based on the promise they were going to get dirt on Hillary. So then Will and Glenn go back and forth about whether or not the admission was first or later. Will asked, there was a later admission on their part. At first, they denied it. Wasn't a question he just asked. Glenn said no. Then Will says they denied it at first. Then Glenn says no, no. Even from the beginning, Donald Trump said, we were told we were going to get information on Hillary. And then Glenn says he didn't admit that until the email came out. So they go back and forth about whether it was adoptions or not. And essentially, Glenn comes back when they finally agreed about some of the timeline of this Trump Tower meeting. Glenn says, I personally don't find that disturbing or surprising, and definitely not illegal. At the very same time that the Trump campaign was trying to get dirt on Hillary Clinton from Russians, the DNC had people going to Ukraine and going to Russia to try and get dirt on Paul Manafort and Donald Trump and his finances. Of course, you want dirt on your political opponent in a race for who's going to be occupying the Oval Office. And of course, you're willing to take dirt from anybody, as long as it's true. Journalists of all people should understand this more than anybody, because it's a kind of code of journalism that if somebody gives you accurate, newsworthy information, you publish it regardless of who the person is and who's giving it to you, how they got it, or what their motives were. Will goes on to say, well, there's a difference between presidential campaigns and journalism, and we're not really bound by the same ethical standards. So Glenn says, oh, so it's okay for journalists to take relevant information from a foreign official or from thieves or from people who are engaged in terrible vendettas and use it to their advantage, but it's not okay for political campaigns? Will says, I think that's the position a lot of people have. For example, Al Gore turned in and refused to see the debate prep handbook of George Bush, but a journalist would have read it, right? Glenn says, okay, but I mean, again, the Democrats were more than eager to pressure Ukrainian officials to get banking records in both Trump and Manafort that they could have used against them in the campaign, which I don't find disturbing, immoral, or illegal. So Will asks, well, then what Al Gore did, was that just Boy Scouty? Glenn says, yes, I do think that, and a lot of Democrats thought the same thing, too. You know, it's a nice ethical thing to do. I'm not condemning him for it, but at the same time, had he used it, I don't think it would have been a crime. All right, so we'll move on from here. Will asks, I'm not asking if it's a crime. That's a narrow question. Glenn says, let me just say that I do not think there's a distinction between what Al Gore got, which was private secret insight into what Bush's people were planning on doing that would have given him an unfair advantage, versus getting accurate information about unethical behavior or potentially illegal behavior that someone running for president of the United States has been engaging in. Will asks, but why are they categorically different? Glenn says, because I think that, in general, it is a categorically positive event when the public learns relevant information about someone who wants to occupy a position as powerful as the U.S. Just like the New York Times published Donald Trump's tax return, despite having no idea who sent it to them, or what the motives were, or what crimes were committed to get them. Then justified it by saying, our role is to inform the public, not to morally judge the people who got us the information. I think political campaigns should be trying to do what they can, short of breaking the law, to get relevant information about the person they're running against. So this time, I'm going to pause, because it seems that it gets probably a lot to digest. So we're going to make this a two-part podcast. So please, after you listen to this one, go ahead and tune back in for part two. Thanks.